In the Moment on SDPB is supported by the South Dakota Humanities Council, presenting the South Dakota Festival of Books, September 20th through 22nd in Brookings.
How a complex natural disaster took shape and what we are learning from it. From SDPB, today is Wednesday, July 10th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, geologist Tim Common with the South Dakota Department of Agriculture and Natural Resources is with us. We'll talk about how flooding on five rivers and a reservoir contributed to a swiftly changing hydrology in action disaster. Then the Dakota Political Junkies tackle a few of the top headlines in the state. We'll focus on social media accounts and how South Dakotans get information from their government. Plus, summer with the symphony. Today we hear Vivaldi's Oboe Concerto in C Major featuring soloist Jeffrey Paul. That's coming a bit later in the hour. We're live today from the Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. We're going to take a deep dive into South Dakota hydrology today, especially as it relates to the devastating flooding seen throughout much of the Southeast in June. We will talk about our land, our rivers, and the rainfall that inundated them. Tim Common is the state geologist with the South Dakota Department of Agriculture and Natural Resources, and he is seated in SDPB studios at the University of South Dakota in Vermilion for our conversation. Tim Common, welcome back to In the Moment. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Lori. Thanks for inviting me on today.
I believe the last time we had you on with us live, there had been an earthquake that we were talking about, and this is a more unusual and more devastating, certainly, event with the flooding. So thanks for your return. I want to go back a little bit. And just seconds ago, the National Weather Service just posted a looking back at what happened thread on X as well. So let's talk about what happened. Tell me a little bit about how the flooding event took shape. What's essential?
Yeah, so essentially we had heavy rainfalls over the Big Sioux, Vermilion, and James Basins that took place over a three-day period, about June 19th, 20th, and 21st. The magnitude of the rainfall was very large. A lot of areas saw at least 10 inches to 15 inches of rain. Some areas even saw up close to 18 inches of rain. And those heaviest of rainfalls occurred basically west of Canton and in the Worthing area. And they fell on both the Big Sioux Basin as well as the Vermilion Basin. But there was also large, widespread areas of heavy rainfall that went as far west as Mitchell and Chamberlain. And the Mitchell area one, that was contributing to the James River Basin. But before that, a day or two before that, these same types of rainfalls moved up through north-central Nebraska and dumped these types of heavy rains in the Niobrara River Basin, which plays into this whole flood event because the Niobrara eventually empties into the Missouri River just upstream of Lewis and Clark Lake.
All right, so a lot of complicated things are happening here, and a lot of comparisons are being made to 2011 or 2014. But here in 2024, I'm wondering if you could give us an outline of what kind of science and computer modeling you have at your disposal now, either that maybe didn't exist in 2011 or 2014, or just what is interesting about how you, as in your role, are watching this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so The precipitation events that brought on this flood were probably similar to the 2014 flood on the Big Sioux River, but the difference was they were much more widespread. And so instead of it just being the Big Sioux River, the Vermilion River, the James River, the Niobrara River, and the Missouri River all came into play here. So we had five rivers and a main stem reservoir that were all contributing to the mechanics of this flood. And the timing on the flood pulses on each of these river systems was important to try to figure out, because if they all synced up and the crests all happened at the same time, the magnitude and the impacts of the flood would have been much worse. Mm-hmm. So we have a lot of stream gauges out there. The U.S. Geological Survey has a good network of stream gauges on these rivers, and the Department of Ag and Natural Resources also maintains a good network of stream gauges, so we can track flows as they're coming down the river. And the River Forecast Center of the International Weather Service then tries to predict what the flows will be downstream at certain times and when the crests will happen. And so we all work together with that information to try to figure out when the floods are going to be at the highest impact and just what how serious those impacts will be.
So when you mentioned stream gauges, I want to be clear, and you mentioned flood pulses, this isn't something you can control at all, or is it?
No, the stream gauge is simply an instrument that tells us how high the river stage is, and then with that information, we can calculate what the actual flow is going down the river. And that's important to know, for example, on the Big Sioux, Vermilion, and James Rivers, because they all empty into the Missouri River. And so they add to the flow of the Missouri River. So knowing what those flows are at their crest and what the timing is of those crests coming into the Missouri will allow us to determine how high the Missouri River is going to get and whether or not it's going to cause flooding problems as well.
Can they sync up? Is there a scenario where they could have all had their flood pulses or their crests at the same time?
Oh, certainly. Mm. We came close in this flood. We got lucky. We got lucky that they got out of sync. But the Missouri River was being controlled mainly by the discharge out of Gavin's Point Dam before the flood hit. And the Corps was not able to reduce those flows significantly out of the Missouri because they had so much water coming into Lewis and Clark Lake through the Niobrara that the lake was getting too high and getting close to overtopping the spillway gates. So they had to keep releasing enough water to prevent that from happening. Then the Big Sioux, Vermilion, and James, all three had these pulses heading down to the Missouri as well. And as it turned out, the Big Sioux crested at North Sioux City on Sunday, which would have been the 23rd of June. The Vermilion River crested the next day on Monday, and then the James River crested the day after that on Tuesday. So they were about a day out of sync, which meant that flows in the Missouri could start dropping off because the other rivers had already crested and was able to take on then the additional flows by the later cresting rivers.
Mm. So tell me how fast you're getting that information, sharing it with other people. Take me into the room and the computer monitors and the phone calls. What does the communication look like? How quickly is the information coming into you? How quickly can you make sense of it? Help me understand that process, if you would.
Right. So there's a lot of agencies involved, both at the local government level, state government level, and the federal government level. And some of the key players are, for example, the county emergency management at the local level. And then at the state level, we have the Ag and Natural Resources, which is where I'm from. We have the DOT because of roads that are being closed, like the interstate. And then we have the governor's office being represented as well. And we also have the Office of Emergency Management, which is in the Department of Public Safety, all interacting together with the local government and with primarily the Corps of Engineers and the National Weather Service at the federal government level. And all of us have information to contribute and responsibilities to analyze this information. And so there was a lot of communication going on amongst all three levels of government there, sharing the information that we had available at the time.
So do you do a lot of understanding what the worst case scenario might be? So when you say, we got a little lucky with when the rivers crested, do you know what the impacts would possibly be if the situation unfolded slightly differently?
Yeah, we would have had, certainly would have had, the flooding impact would have been even worse down in the North Sioux City, Dakota Dunes, McCook Lake area if it had all crested at the same time, because the Missouri would have been flooding more, and then it also would have created a backwater effect for the Big Sioux. In other words, with the Missouri being higher, the floodwaters of the Big Sioux would have been slowed down much more and sat there much longer and got higher. With the Missouri being lower, those floodwaters can move through faster and it keeps the crest from getting any higher. So that's on the Missouri side. But on the Big Sioux side, I mean, that was by far and away the worst damage that happened. And that was because of the record flow that we had coming down the Big Sioux with a high volume of water. And it was hard to predict the timing of the crest. And that timing kept getting moved up. And before we knew it, the crest was there about a day and a half earlier than it originally was predicted to get there. And so that created a situation where all of a sudden you're out of time and the crest of the flood is here.
Yeah. Say more about that, because I'm trying to picture when you say that, you know, it kept getting moved up. You mean your analysis kept shifting with the information, or more rain kept falling and so it kept changing, or the river behaved in a way that we didn't know? Or so help me understand what you mean by that, because my mind's going like 10 different directions.
Yeah, so the timing of the crest is put out by the River Forecast Center for the Missouri River Basin. And they have models that they use that look at the water coming down the river, and then they predict when it's going to crest at specific points along the river. And the times that the crests were being predicted, like over the weekend, sort of in that Friday-Saturday time frame, were out further than when it really happened. So in other words, the crest came faster than their models were predicting it would come. And I think that has to do with the fact that this was a flood that was off the charts. So the models are calibrated really up to what the highest flood had been previously, and that was in 2014 on the Big Sioux River. But once you start getting beyond that, and this one was way beyond that, then the models can have some trouble accurately predicting what's really going to happen. And I think that plays into part of you know, why the timing kept getting shifted, is that the models just weren't able to accurately predict it.
Yeah. So I want to talk about impacts in a moment, particularly some impacts that maybe we haven't considered fully, and a little bit about the future. But from what you just said, before we get to that part, then are the models recalibrated? What are we learning right now about this, from the severity of this event, that is going to help us prepare better in the future?
Right. So that's exactly what will happen, is during the post-flood analysis, this event will be added into the National Weather Service models, and they'll be able to handle floods that are of up to this magnitude more accurately, because our models will contain that information. On the state side, we have models too, but our models are used for predicting what's going to be inundated with flood water, given the flows that the National Weather Service predicts are going to come through. We can predict what's going to be flooded, and our model actually did pretty good. It simulated this flood event pretty well, but we'll still be able to tweak it and make it even better now that we're able to put this information into it for future flood events. It was the magnitude of this flood was, like I said, much worse than the previous bad one, which was in 2014 on the Big Sioux. And the flood in 2014, we think, was somewhere between a 100 and 500-year flood. So this one will be even greater, probably somewhere between a 500 and 1,000-year flood.
Right. But I'll say the same thing that the roofer said when they fixed my shingles after a hailstorm. I said, oh, this should be good for another 25 years. He said, or tomorrow. So there are, and I guess this gets to this idea of how often we anticipate having severe weather events. And I was just looking at the book Ecology of Dakota Landscapes this morning as I prepped for this conversation, and Carter Johnson and Dennis Knight saying that we need comprehensive plans to mitigate adverse effects of climate change. So my question to you is, as we look at more severe events, how are we developing plans to mitigate some of those adverse effects of climate change?
Well, I think we have to adjust our thinking on how we do prepare for these types of future events, because one thing we are seeing is that these 100-year plus floods have been coming every 5 years in the Big Sioux Basin. So, you know, there was the 2011 flood on more on the Missouri side, but same type of sort of origin of it. Then there was the 2014 flood, the 2019 flood, and now the 2024 flood. So the precipitation patterns that generate those types of floods seem to be coming together more and more frequently. And so I think we have to assume that, these things aren't going to happen, every 10, 20, 30 years. They're going to be coming more often than that.
What happens to the watershed? Some of the impacts that we don't think of. We focus at first, I think rightfully so, on the loss to people's livelihoods and lives and property. But it's also time to consider what happens to trees and riverbanks and erosion and fish and the ecosystem. What do you know about the impacts of an event like this that maybe people have not been considering?
Well, certainly erosion is one of the big ones. We lose a lot of sediment, gets moved into the river channel and then deposited elsewhere. So that shows up after the floodwaters have receded. There are, in some cases, like on the Vermilion River especially, we've seen some huge erosion of the bank where the river has cut a large channel quite a ways outside of where it normally would flow, and that's taken farmland. It's also threatened homes. Those are really, really some of the big impacts that happens, but it does have an impact on vegetation as well. There could be some trees, that will die because of it or at least be set back. Those kinds of things are some examples of some of the impacts that we see.
Yeah, pollution, just the things that are not moving down, the increase in pollution, sewage line breakages, ag runoff. What do we see about water quality, and how long does it take a watershed to recover?
Well, the immediate concern is in the floodwaters that are remaining behind. They've got all kinds of nasty things in them, so people need to stay out of those floodwaters until they recede. But also there's the example at Vermilion where the city's wastewater discharge lines ran underneath the river on their way to the wastewater treatment plant. And because of erosion on the bank as well as erosion of the bed of the river, all three of those lines were severed, which meant that raw sewage is now dumping into the Vermilion River. And so that there's work in progress now to put a temporary line in place to handle that waste, and then eventually a permanent line will go back underneath the river. But those are certainly impacts that create water quality problems.
Mm. If I'm just moved here, if I'm a new mayor or a new senator, I just got elected to, state house or something, I'm going to be making policy. What sorts of things do you want me to know? What would be some of your advice to somebody who is moving into a community leadership, whether it's in a township or statewide, that they need to understand about South Dakota hydrology and these kinds of events?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest things, and this really applies statewide, is that people are attracted to water bodies to build housing developments on. They want to be around lakes, they want to be next to rivers, they want to be next to creeks. And we got to remember that, especially with the rivers and creeks, those are the floodplains and those are meant to take flood waters. So there's only so much you can do to control those floods. They're going to happen anyway. So I think that's the big thing that planners need to be aware of, is that building in close proximity to flowing bodies of water in their floodplains is not necessarily a good idea.
Mm. Any final thoughts, anything I didn't ask, or a lot of questions that you're getting frequently from the public that you want to make sure you take this time to address to a statewide audience?
I think a couple of things to be aware of is, just the fact that we are starting to see these flood events happen more frequently. So I think we need to be aware as a people and as a state that this is something that is a threat, and we need to take a look at, where we live and what kind of danger we may be in, and be prepared well in advance for any flood that may come our way.
Mm-hmm. I won't ask you how much you slept during the 5 days.
Some nights, not very much. Yeah.
Well, thank you for that, and thank you for coming here today. Anytime that you have information to share, we will be here for you. Tim Kalman, State Geologist with South Dakota Department of Agriculture and Natural Resources, thank you so much.
Thank you, Lori.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Before the break, I spoke with our state geologist to understand the science of southeastern South Dakota's June flooding. Now we're going to talk a little bit about its politics. Our Dakota political junkies are going to take a look at how government officials respond to information they receive from scientists, and we'll look at how those leaders communicated with South Dakotans in the flood's path, and how they have, of course, been criticized for their communications during the disaster. Michael Card is a political scientist and professor emeritus at the University of South Dakota. He is seated across the table from me in SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls now. Dr. Card, welcome back.
Thanks for having me here.
And joining us on the phone, John Hunter, publisher emeritus of the Madison Daily Leader and inductee to the South Dakota Newspaper Hall of Fame. Mr. John Hunter, welcome back as well.
Hi, Lori. Thanks for the invitation.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about social media accounts first, and then let's move into a little bit of flood disaster response and communication. It's John, I want to start with you a little bit from the media side of things. When you cover the way political leaders communicate, this social media thing is, it's not new, but you've been around before there was an X account for a governor. How did governors used to talk to people when it came to something like a flood disaster, and how have you seen it change over time?
Well, I think it's been a dramatic change, especially for Governor Noem. The difference is that really she and her public relations office or outreach office really want to say, we're going to tell you what we want to tell you. We don't want to respond to questions. So she doesn't like press conferences. She doesn't really, if you call in to ask the governor questions, they'll be deferred. If you call to cabinet positions, they'll say you need to submit your questions in writing. We might get back to you. But they have, in fact, and I'm not sure these are the exact words, but basically said, if you want to know anything, just go to social media and we'll tell you what we want to tell you. And that's a big difference. And I think there is a naturally citizens of South Dakota and small newspapers and radio stations and TV stations want to be able to ask their leaders questions. Might be something that might be uncomfortable, might be something that's not going well, rather than a very positive public message that can be sent out on social media. So Governor Noem has chosen this path. I think it's hard on citizens, harder, at least on the media, trying to get answers on behalf of citizens.
And meanwhile, more than 750,000 people were following the combined X and Facebook of Governor Kristi Noem's official social media accounts. And then those accounts recently just went dark over the 4th of July weekend. Mike Card, there's a new account, Ian Fury with the governor's office said, you know, follow the governor here on social media. Her personal account was still active. Do we have any idea what happened?
Other than what you just described is the one account is gone. The Kristi Noem account is still there with nearly 500,000 followers. And there are 13 followers on the governor's office, largely because there are press releases there. And so there is little new information. I think there's actually 13 news media and one person.
It's increasing quickly as people find out about it. But
but that was yesterday.
It's a huge drop. Does it matter?
Well, I think what John mentioned is what really matters, and that is that the governor's office is filtering what news they wish to give out. And I think we all understand that is that if you're an elected official, you'd like to give your side of the story. What it doesn't necessarily provide is an answer or a response even to what the citizens want to know as filtered through the media. And usually the media have thought about these and have more access to information, do a far deeper background look at what the issues are and what might be related to what. And so I'm probably one of the rare people that I believe that we do need the press. Of course, here I am talking to two press people, but as well as the rest of the
citizenry. It's a friendly room for that, yes.
You don't have to convince us.
But
go ahead.
The public wants to know, and the public has a right to know. And I think when we start to limit information that's given and limit access to our elected officials, democracy suffers because you have to be able to know in order to participate in the process of democracy.
And we have no way of knowing, John, why this decision was made, because the governor's office will not answer that question. They just say, it's over here now. So we don't know what happened, and we try not to speculate on this show. So I don't want to get into a 5-minute, it could be this, it could be that. But that's frustrating, John, because nobody knows why it happened, and it could be newsworthy why it happened. There are scenarios in my mind that would say that would be a newsworthy thing that we would the public would need to know. But it's silence. It's a complete no answer.
Well, I'll jump back
with
in,
you, Laurie, and I think you're very accurate in that. That is it news? I mean, it's probably newsworthy. Again, if someone gives up those that number of accounts or followers, and we don't know what it is now. So silence is very frustrating, and it isn't necessary. There's no reason you can't speak about this, unless it's something embarrassing or. And in some senses, I'd say it's better to be silent than to tell an untruth, that it's for some this reason and that's not the reason. So I'm hoping we'll still find out that there's merely a delay, and we'll hear an announcement in the next few days or whatever that there's a reason for it. But it is frustrating for the citizens of South Dakota.
Mike, what were you going to add there?
I was just going to say it, you know, I think one of the rationale for a little bit of citizen discomfort about the entire response to the flood is that, you know, things changed so fast, as Professor Kalman noted, and lo and behold, as things change fast, information gets to the elected officials and the officials in charge of responses slowly. Mm-hmm. It goes as fast as it can, as he noted. Previously, I don't have the exact quote, but he said, you know, the models in a flood like this aren't very accurate at the moment. Sometimes there are errors, and so in terms of helping out the McCook Lake folk, they may not have had the information there.
Yeah.
And so
I want to get to that. I have one more question about the social media thing, which is relevant to McCook Lake citizens and some of the questions they were answering. And I think one of the things Tim Kalman said is that the models weren't, this was such an extreme event that sometimes the models can't keep up with something that they haven't seen yet. And so that increased the challenges that they were looking at, that the analysts were looking at as the flood was unfolding. John Hunter, the archive disappears. And we don't think of social media being it's not a reliable archive. It's not like a public archive, but it is a very useful way to scroll back and say she was here on this day and on this day she said this and here is tape from this interview because she is posting it, and that's all erased now if the account goes dark and people are piecing it together from other places. It went dark after people had pieced together where she was at during the flood event. I'm not saying those are related. I'm just saying that happened in late June, and then over the 4th of July the social media accounts left their public view. But John, what do we lose when a governor's official account disappears like that, as far as access to any kind of history and archival footage that we might be inadvertently starting to rely on?
Well, I think it's a huge loss, frankly. And again, you can document. It's part of, I think, really a broader issue of open records, open documents, open meetings that go on. And if you choose to hide certain documents or erase them or shred them or whatever that is, I think there's a loss there. Now, I'm not saying every document and every conversation, every email should be made public, but these are things that were made public. These are, and they were made public for a reason, whether it was for it was in the this is the governor's official thing. This is not her personal one or a campaign one. So it was released for a reason, whether it was I was here or I'm promoting myself. I mean, you can still promote yourself on official channels, but and then it gets erased. It is a big deal. And it's just not like we're finding document or we're looking for documents that never existed. This is stuff that was once made public and now is gone.
Mm-hmm. Mike, I'm thinking of Alexander Heffner's book, The Documentary History of the United States, where he has, you know, the founding documents and, you know, famous speeches. And then in the most recent version, he starts adding tweets. And, you know, because this becomes the documentary history of the United States. And in the introduction, he eloquently discusses the decision to include certain tweets in the documentary history of the United States. As a political scientist, does that blow your mind as much as it blows mine?
Well, I think the other side of it is our laws haven't kept up with technological changes.
Yeah.
You know, and Twitter or X, and I still call it Twitter. Boy, was that a Freudian slip. Twitter, since Supreme Court Justice Amy Coney Barrett said that she's going to call it Twitter, so I figure I can too. But, you know, it's those are... If that is the official account and it's made because she's a governor, that should be a public record.
Yeah.
And our record retention laws don't cover much in terms of social media.
All right. So let's talk about flood response and some of the criticisms that Governor Noem is taking very publicly from media outlets and citizens about how she warned people, when she warned people, and what she was doing when she wasn't warning people. John Hunter, you wanted to begin with this, that it's, I mean, let's just say right up front, it's so easy to armchair quarterback things. But when you look at the timeline, do you think there are some valid criticisms about where she was and where you would normally expect a governor to be?
I'd love to refer to another journalist here. Terry Wooster wrote a column in the last few days about governor responses to natural disasters. And he said, I didn't see the Noem one up front because he's not an active journalist like now, but he was at a front row seat for Governors Janklow, Rounds, and Dugard in each of those. And he saw them in those situations. And he said there's a broad range of possible ways to respond it. Janklow was very much out in front, right? Even his statue in Pier has him with a bullhorn pointing at something, and he loved to go there, and he would bark orders and so forth, and mm-hmm. he was very active. But Governors Dugard and Rounds were more behind the scenes. But Terry did say that they were in the emergency operations center, you know, 6 a.m. till midnight, and they were working with people and making decisions. In other words, they had a different style than Governor Janklow, but they were still involved. They were still there. And Terry ends his piece, and I'll get into my own thoughts in a second, but Terry ends the piece basically saying, disasters are when South Dakotans need a governor the most, no matter what their crisis management style. So I think at the moment, I think most South Dakotans would have preferred a different response out of Governor Noem. In other words, yes, she did do the press conference there, and she doesn't. I don't think they're expecting any governor to lift sandbags or to drive a backhoe or something to help that. But somehow you want them to be engaged, to be there, to maybe to put an arm around someone who has lost a home. Or I just think it seems to be more of an active thing rather than being in another city or state.
All right. She did a press conference on Sunday. Left the state, did some events, one including a fundraiser in Tennessee. She returned to South Dakota for press conferences on Monday and Tuesday. So it's not as if she did nothing. We need to go for now, but I think there's more to say. Oh, that clock is hurting me today. Mike Carr, John Hunter, thank you so much for being here. We appreciate your time.
Thanks for having us.
Take care.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. We closed the show today with our signature summer with the symphony. Jeffrey Paul is one of the South Dakota Symphony Orchestra's principal players. He's an oboist, but he's also a composer, a conductor, a jazz pianist, and a leader in the South Dakota music community. His innovation in all these roles has truly changed our musical landscape. Paul is the featured soloist in the performance you're about to hear, Antonio Vivaldi's Oboe Concerto in C Major. It's a Baroque piece where the oboe is in conversation with the orchestra, and it's one of 12 concerti for the instrument that Vivaldi crafted. Now, this performance was recorded live in January at the Washington Pavilion in Sioux Falls. Here is the South Dakota Symphony Orchestra under the direction of Delta David Geyer performing Vivaldi's Oboe Concerto in C Major featuring soloist Jeffrey Paul.
Thank you.
That is Jeffrey Paul, featured soloist for Summer with the Symphony, that was recorded live with the South Dakota Symphony Orchestra under the direction of Maestro Delta David Geyer. You heard Vivaldi Oboe Concerto in C major. Summer with the Symphony airs throughout the summer on In the Moment, and you can find more about that on our website at sdpb.org. That is our show for today. We hope that it served you. Eliza Blue returns to the program tomorrow. We will talk about her new book, and I think she's playing for us live. Yes, I'm getting the nod from the producers. From all of us at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. We thank you for listening.